CliffCentral.com. All right. It is that time of the week where we do the burning platform. Of course, your chance to catch up on all the current affairs. This week, though, we've got something different. Justice Malala, who started the burning platform with us 9 years ago, and was a part of the foundation of this current affairs show. At that stage, there was nothing else like it. Now there are a few other podcasts. There are a few other shows that are doing current affairs talk the way that we are, for a full and uninterrupted hour with guests, all kinds of things. Justice really established himself as one of the breakaway, outspoken people in current affairs. And remember, it was a very different time 9 years ago. People couldn't really speak as freely as they do now. We take it for granted. And in some ways, things have got better. In some ways, things have definitely got worse. But we also talk a little bit about some of the big stories that are in the news in South Africa right now. We get to that at the end of the interview. The main reason Justice is in the country, because he lives in New York now, is to release his new book, which I'll tell you about in the course of the interview. But it's essentially about those fractious events that occurred in Easter of 1993, when Chris Hani was assassinated and when Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk had to do all the things they could to stop South Africa from descending into chaos. And some people would say that we're in a similar situation almost every other day in South Africa, but I do think that was the closest we came to an outright civil war, and I don't think many people would disagree with that. Here it is, though. I'm going to let you hear it and let you take part in this amazing discussion. It is Justice Malala's triumphant return to the burning platform, and I'm really, really pleased that you get to hear it here on CliffCentral.com for the first time this morning. Well, it is auspicious that we should be sitting here. I know for many people it's a cold, wintry morning, but it isn't as cold as the day that Justice writes about in his new book, because although it was back in 1993, so we're approaching an anniversary this year, it was obviously one of the most defining moments in South African history. But as has already been said, Justice has also been a defining voice in South Africa post-1993, and for a very long time has remained one of the most sought-after and admired commentators, which is one of the reasons we liked having him on the burning platform for those years that we did. And he hasn't ruined his reputation like certain other political commentators by being paid by Herman Mashaba, but we'll leave that alone for the moment, right, Justice? Nice to see you, my friend.
It's so good to be here. Thank you, everyone, for turning up. Thank you for having me. Burning Platform is such a special place for me. I have, I don't know if you guys, if I may segue for just a bit, but one of the things about me is that I was born here in Johannesburg, I grew up in Hammanskraal. People from Joburg, you know, everyone's from everywhere else. They don't like this place. They don't think it's their home and so forth and so forth. But I think as a kid, I picked up this weird pronunciation of the letter R.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when you asked me to come on, I kept on thinking, no one's going to understand a word I'm saying, my R and this and so forth. So, you know, I'd like to thank you for the therapy, basically.
Well, I'll tell you, the people of Hammanskraal have other things to worry about
at the moment. I'll tell you that, for sure.
With cholera and all the rest of it. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time on the book, which really deserves a lot more than a little bit of time, and I encourage everybody to take a look at it. It's written just as beautifully, and it's amazing how, even though I was a very young school kid at the time, I remember those events probably because I'm a history nerd, but you've told them in just the most stark, frightening, nail-biting, goosebump way that you actually go through the timeline and you're there at the moment that Janusz Walus climbs out of his red car, walks over, and pulls out his gun. And you can kind of remember, even if you are young, and there are many people here who might not remember the actual events, but you would have seen the footage and everything afterwards of, you know, Chris Hani in that tracksuit. There's so much to talk about here. We'll spend a lot of time talking about this, but I know a lot of people want to hear your thoughts on what's currently going on, and I know you keep up to date with all of that. So we're turning this into a burning platform special as well this morning. So let's just start with that inauspicious weekend back in Easter of 1993,
yeah,
which is when all the action took place. Why did you feel that this You kind of say so here, but why do you feel that this moment was so seminal in this country?
I think South Africa had gone through a lot in the period from 1990. Nelson Mandela came out of prison on February 11. The ANC, SACP, others were unbanned on February 2nd. And that was a huge, joyous moment for many of us, myself included. You know, from the darkness of apartheid to this new wave of possibility, of hope that finally things are going to change. But it didn't work out that way. 1990 came and went. If you lived here in what was the PWV, huge amounts of violence were unleashed. Later we found out that, you know, they were sponsored by the state, paying the IFP or IFP, parts of the IFP to attack township residents in Soweto. People forget that, you know, in that time, if you were coming to work from Soweto, you lived in fear that men would just enter your train coach and carriage and attack you. That there were train massacres. There were massacres in the townships, in Buipatong, in Sebokeng, all parts of South Africa. So the negotiations weren't going that well. But this for me was the ultimate provocation. Ipsos had done a survey in 1992, and one of the questions was, who do you think is the most trusted, most who do you love most in the political sphere? And Nelson Mandela came first, and second was Chris Hani. So Chris Hani's image, if you will, in among particularly young black activists was very different from Nelson Mandela's. Nelson Mandela was the face of negotiations. It was, if there was a sense that, for example, on August 6, 1990, the Umkhonto weSizwe lifted the, suspended the armed struggle. And Nelson Mandela was blamed for that. It was, oh, you're a sellout, and so forth and so forth.
There's still people saying that now.
There's still people saying that. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit. But Chris Hani was seen as the man who didn't sell out, who stood fast, who showed his fist to the apartheid government and said, you know, we want these are demands, and we're not stepping back from
that. And represented a younger and angrier generation, in a way.
Angrier, but hopeful too. I mean, people forget the key thing about Chris Hani is that when it was time for war, he fought. But when it was time for peace, you know, Chris Hani, if you take, for example, today and say, who are these people who are MKMVA, Umkhonto weSizwe military veterans, and you and I used to talk about them a lot on the Burning Platform, these young MK people, and you say, but guy, you're 35. How can you say you're MK when, you know, MK suspended the armed struggle in 1990? Where did you train? It's been 30. You were five.
Like the veterans in Zimbabwe.
Exactly. So, but part of it is that some of those people, maybe the slightly older ones than the 35-year-olds, came from township protection units. And Chris Hani was already at that time thinking very deeply about these young people. What do we do with them? How do we help them integrate into society post a democratic settlement? So I find it interesting that people want to almost paint Chris Hani as a direct opposite of Nelson Mandela, that Mandela's sold out and Chris Hani was this pure figure who didn't want peace. He wanted peace. He worked for peace. I write a thing in the book somewhere about what was found on his desk on the day he was murdered. On the Thursday, he was at his office and kept on doing notes about a Peace Corps. How do you take these young people into becoming soldiers for piece, as it were, or how do you integrate them and so on. He was thinking deeply about those things. So,
and you go into a lot of detail about the relationship between Mandela and Hani, which is, I think, oft misunderstood by people. Mm-hmm. Mandela had issued a special order to his own office that as much time as he could have with Chris Hani, he wanted.
Yeah, yeah.
So if he had to travel somewhere, Chris should come with.
Yeah, yeah.
He wanted to. He was fascinated by this young man.
Yeah, he was fascinated by him. He was a bit scared of him, that this guy, you know, if he didn't, I think Mandela saw himself as, if I want to sell a democratic settlement, I have to sell it to Chris. If I can sell it to him, he can sell it to anyone. And so he made him part of the difficulty of negotiation and the times of negotiation and the times of the small gains that the ANC was making in its negotiations with the National Party and the government of the time. So he loved him deeply, and he saw a lot of himself in Chris Hani. You know, Chris Hani was a radical, was a militant. Mandela, people forget that Mandela was a radical and a militant in the 1940s. The Mandela of 1960. Or the Mandela of the 1990s that, oh, you know, he wants reconciliation and peace. This was the first man to leave South Africa and go and train in Ethiopia. He was the first ANC person to hold a gun in his hand and actually train to take up arms. So the idea that Mandela was this, you know, cuddly teddy bear is what I like about those two men, if you will, is that just be careful about saying, oh, they were absolutely this, when they were this and other. And I think it's all of us. Part of the thing I wanted to show in the book, and I'd encourage many of you to watch a movie called Selma. It's about Martin Luther King. And it shows a moment of weakness in Martin Luther King's life when he's marching with thousands of people. And he says, the police are going to murder us. Let's stop and turn back. And people said he's weak, that he is a sellout, and so forth. In this week of Chris Hani's murder, for me, Nelson Mandela was resolute at times. And at times he said, I've made a mistake, and maybe I need to work it back. And that, for me, is actually ultimate leadership. He was human. He made mistakes, but he fixed them and kept on going. And I like that about him. I really do.
Well, I remember also, and I'm sure everybody who's old enough here does, that was the moment we probably came closest to a complete disruption in civil society. You know, the army being called in, the total descent into chaos in the townships that was planned by the people who wanted to murder Chris Hani. They had a list. Yeah. And Mandela was at the top of the list. Joe Slovo was number two. Chris Hani was number three. And when Janusz Walus and Clive Darby Lewis and the rest of the conspirators, some of whom we're still not sure who they are. I mean, Gay Darby Lewis, she got off.
Yeah, she was.
It's amazing how close we did come to total civil war at that point. I remember people stocking up on things and saying, this is the moment, right?
Absolutely. I think as a trigger, Clive W. Lewis, Janusz Walus, whoever else, as you say, was involved. You know, I don't know if I make it explicit enough in the book, but there are people like F.W. de Klerk and others. I'm not sure if they actually realized that they were as much targets of this plan as Nelson Mandela and Joe Slovo and Chris Hani and others. Because the idea was that you kill the most popular leader in the ANC, you spark this anger, but you spark it so that the hardliners in the army would say, look, and would be justified or find justification to say it's time to kick out FW and his cabinet, who were pretty useless people themselves, but you kick out a civilian government and install an army led by the generals, and they say, reset everything to 1980, to 1975, and it was working then. We kept everyone under the cosh.
Martial law.
Martial law and so forth and right. So de Klerk, who was seen as a sellout and, you know, all these things, would have been totally sidelined or even jailed. Mandela and them would have been sent back to prison. And essentially, you'd have the generals taking over. That was their plan, to trigger essentially a coup d'etat. They didn't mm-hmm. want to take over themselves. They wanted the army to take over, and it would be, now it's all good and so forth. And the key thing is that they were frustrated. If you say we want chaos to happen, and Mandela and his comrades and others managed to say, yeah, I mean, there were huge outbreaks of protest and all kinds of anarchy. But if you contain it, then you don't give the army that reason to say, let's take over.
One of the ways that it was contained, again, people who are old enough might remember, is Mandela went on TV that very weekend, I think it was the night after, and managed to be strong, stand firm, not give any ground, but at the same time, right at the end, despite wearing a jacket that he didn't want to wear. And these are the kind of details you'll only get from the book. But he then called for calm and peace and said, if we incite violence now, we will be handing this country over to the people who don't want you to be free.
Yeah. I mean, so the story of the speech is actually the story of speeches. So I one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was because April 10, 1993 was, I was an intern at the Star, and basically all the senior journalists, Easter weekend, no one wants to work, and so they all take off. And as the interns, it was myself and a few others, were taken up to the newsroom and told, these are the numbers for the cops. These are the numbers for this. You're in charge. And there was one news editor who, you know, sort of oversaw us. But basically, there was no one. The paper had been designed. The Sunday paper had been designed, and it was ready to go. So we were just supposed to sit there and call the cops every hour. You know, what's happening? Okay.
Well, now you'd just be put on hold. So at least you could have got through to them then.
But what happened is that Chris Hani gets murdered. I get sent out to Don Park, and then later in the afternoon, I get sent out to Soweto, and, you know, I come back, I scribble my stuff. But I always had the memory that Nelson Mandela went on television that evening and gave a fantastic speech, and that calmed things down. So when I set off to write it, I kept on thinking, yeah, that's the pivotal part. How did this speech do this?
That's how the story goes.
Actually, it's Mandela arrives back from Kunu late in the evening. He only gets to the SABC at 10:30. He reads from the auto queue.
Can't really see.
No one is watching. The SABC had the movie on. What was it called now? Somewhere in the book.
But there was a 7 o'clock bulletin, which most people would watch.
Yeah, he missed that.
He missed that. Then there was an 8 o'clock one, which the rest of the people would watch. By this time,
people are not watching. People are worrying about other things or have gone to sleep, and so forth and so forth. So Mandela, it's historic. For the first time, a black man, a man whose name you could never mention on the SABC. Remember, if you said Nelson Mandela on the SABC, you got a 5-year automatic. You went to jail. If you quoted him, 5 years automatic. You know, it was... You don't talk about this man. He was banned. So for the first time, and this is hysteric, Nelson Mandela goes on national television We talk about family meetings now with Cyril Ramaphosa. Actually, that was the original, the first family meeting. But no one, very few people actually saw it. So Nelson Mandela then, a few days later, says, why? That didn't work out as we wanted. So then he says, I have to go back and do this again. And for me, it's a beautiful moment of leadership, knowing that, oh, I did that. I tried that. It didn't work. Let's do it again. And that's when he writes those pivotal, amazing words to the speech that everyone quotes. So people like me and others always quoted that speech that Mandela on Saturday evening went on TV and said this. But actually it took him 3 days to write those lines and to give the speech that really kind of began to turn things. And that's the speech when he says, I'm reaching out to all South Africans, black and white. He says, a white man full of hate came to our land and murdered our beloved son. I'm paraphrasing. And he says, a white woman saw the killer and had the presence of mind to call and memorize the register number plate. And had the presence of mind to call the police.
Rieta
Harmse was her name. And you know, within 35, 40 minutes, Janus Wallis was arrested. And that speech by you know, if you think about Janus Wallis and Clive W. Lewis, they wanted to say black against white. Mm-hmm. That was the key thing in their attempt to spark this conflict. And Mandela saying, a white man full of hate came to our land and killed Chris Hani. A white woman saw the killer and memorized the number plate and called the police. Was a beautiful juxtaposition of, they are trying to make you think in terms of race and black and white and enemy, friend, and so forth. Here's the thing. The same people that say whites are enemies of blacks, a white woman saw this. Yeah. And it took the sting out of that week. I mean, it's not a turning point that many people say Mandela stopped the war. There were other things, and I'll talk about them here. But that was one of the most powerful moments of that week. And that's when you begin to see a realization that actually the attempt here is to destroy all of us, not just go for the one or go for the other. It's for all of us to turn around and say, these white people and these black people, you see them, us, them, and cause this.
Yes, a narrative that bears repeating some of the time. There are characters in this book, though, that are very much still part of our lives. Mm. Obviously, just recently, Janusz Wallis was released on parole. Clive Darby Lewis was also released some time ago, but died shortly thereafter of lung cancer. There must be, because you did a lot of research here, you looked at their testimony at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, for which neither of them were exonerated because the TRC believed they were withholding a lot of information, that they weren't telling the full story. You hear lots of rumors, and you've now done the research. There are people who still talk about this hidden, invisible hand behind the whole assassination of Chris Hani. Do you believe there was more to it than this small and quite incompetent conspiracy that very nearly caused the chaos that it wanted to?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two levels to it. So the first thing is that I honestly believe that there was a cell which worked to pull off the actual murder itself. And I think it goes beyond Janusz Wallis and Clive Darby Lewis. So there are 6-7 other people who were, certainly one was waiting in line that if Janusz Wallis didn't do it, he'd be available to pull the trigger. I believe that some of the neighbors, some of the providers of the gun, some of the people who pointed to this is how we, you know, a silencer was supposed to be used on that day. It wasn't used, and all those people. So I think the actual cell itself was about 7 people. And I think the investigation was very much, let's find the key people, let's forget about prosecuting the minor players in that cell. So I think they got away with murder. The wider conspiracy is something that right from the beginning has been spoken about. And I think this is should be a source of shame and of, I think it's, I was saying to
you. Just look behind you for the next few
minutes. No. I'll tell you what it is. I want to put it this way. You and I sit here and we say, oh, you know, we're going on the burning platform and we sit there and we analyze. Because you don't have the might and the power of the state behind you to say, if I'm going to analyze how a child, a newborn, ends up in a cardboard box in a hospital, the best I can do is to analyze how we got here and perhaps to use my voice to condemn why we are here. The ANC government, since 1994, has failed with the SACP, with Jeremy Cronin, with all the others. Every year they stand up and say, our hero Chris Hani was murdered and so forth. Then they go and sit in government. But not once has anyone said, we've got the might of the state. Let us reopen this case and talk about the allegations of there were cigarettes and Fanta or Coca-Cola cans. It looks like someone was sitting there staking out this. So every year you hear, yeah, and there were these people and so forth. Why don't, if we are in power, why don't we use the power that we have in the state to do these things? So the conspiracy around the murder of Chris Hani is fueled by an ANC which can do something about it and doesn't do anything about it. So again and again, I find myself just dismayed and wowed and disappointed by the fact that we seem to have a state that analyzes and never does anything. So as I said, I'm from Hammanskraal. I went on Sunday to see my mother, Saturday. And you know, the village right next to my mother's is called Stengvater. It's been called Stengvater. Stengvater. Because the water has always been
smelly.
Shit, basically. Yeah. You know, so you continue these things. And so I have all my ANC friends, all my, the Minister of Health, Joe Patla, who I have a lot of time for, and others are over there. They're analyzing this thing. It's just not your job to analyze. It's my job to analyze. You fix the problem. You're in power. That's why I gave you 5 years. So this whole thing around Chris Hani and the plot, the conspiracy and how far it goes, We could have resolved this with the TLC, could have resolved this with the police, the hawks there, and all sorts of bodies.
It's almost as if there wasn't even any curiosity. It's
like so in fact, I would say the past 30 years, if anyone says to me, do you believe there was a conspiracy to kill Chris Hani? I say to you, I can talk till the cows come home about, oh, this one was here, and da, da, da. And there are so many theories and, oh, arms deals and so forth. If anyone is serious in this country, in this government, to find the real truth, why hasn't there been a reopening of the case so that the Hani family can find some closure, some peace from this? Why is it, or maybe, the real conspiracy is that, you know, people enjoy standing up on the 10th of April every year for 30 years talking about Chris Hani but not doing anything to give that family closure.
All right, so then that brings us more to the present, because the people who conspiracy theorists say would have benefited the most from this within the ANC, there are obviously lots of people who benefited on the outside, are two people who've subsequently been presidents of this country. The one currently is, because a lot of people say that Mandela was either grooming Chris Hani or that Chris Hani was grooming himself to eventually take a far more powerful leadership role within the movement. Do you believe that that's what, I mean, now I'm asking you to predict.
No, actually you're not, because that question was asked. Steve Chweta in 2003 went on television. You'll remember he went on, Deborah Pata used to have Third Degree, I think it was called. Went on Third Degree and said, yes, the cops, I can confirm that the police are investigating an allegation made by Thabo Mbeki that Tokyo Sekgwale, Cyril Ramaphosa, and Matthew Sposa. That they were going around alleging
that he benefited
from that, and so forth and so forth. So in fact, the assassination of Chris Hani has almost destroyed the ANC. All these people that we mentioned now have been at loggerheads, at war with each other.
Ever since.
And my question is this. Thabo Mbeki was the president of South Africa. Jacob Zuma was the president of South Africa. Cyril Ramaphosa is the president. Why hasn't any one of them, even Jacob Zuma has said that he thinks that something was going on there. Well, he was the head of intelligence of the ANC. Why didn't he ask those questions? Why hasn't he done anything about it? So the matter of Chris Hani continues today to be a huge source of, I think, part of the pain of the ANC, part of the pain that it doesn't know, of the trauma that it doesn't perhaps know, or deliberately decides, I'm just going to keep this under the carpet, and it's the family secret we don't talk about, with all the power that the ANC has enjoyed and still enjoys today.
So the book is available here, but I want to just fast forward a little bit to the present. It must be very nice for you living in America to come back here with the dollar and rand at this current exchange rate. Anthea, who's here, told me just now it's worth 1970-something? Oh, my God. Okay, so, Justice, what are you buying us afterwards? Do we have to buy your book, or are you going to give us your books for free? Because we need all the help we can get.
Anthea, I hope... one of the worst things about being so enmeshed with South Africa, because I still earn a living here and so forth, is that you're watching that ticker as it goes 1976, 1970, and you think, what am I earning? Where's my earnings going?
Yeah.
But I think the key things, so there's a little graphic, and I'm sure Anthea can do it for us, where you look at the lira, you look at the, all the emerging market currencies, right? And you say, oh, they're all taking a beating because the dollar is too strong or the Fed is doing this and so forth. But if you look at it long enough, you start realizing that there's the rand on its own.
We're underperforming all the underperformers.
And the key thing to that is that we are the masters of their own goal. Everything that we should just do as a matter of course that everyone else does, we just, you know, in Setswana, you just go off into the bush, basically.
Well, it especially feels like that right now. I mean, I look at Haman's Kraal, which obviously is close to home. It is home to you. I look at what's going on in parts of KwaZulu-Natal. I look at the electricity crisis. It's almost like they've just decided in the ANC, we don't know what to do. Hands up. We're just going to walk away. Because it's not as if anyone's there in, you know, crisis meetings. You don't get the impression there's any urgency here at all.
Yeah, I mean, the ANC is analyzing. This is the problem.
Analysis paralysis.
It's just, you know, anyone, you know, you say to the ANC, anyone in the ANC, and you say, let's have a, what's going on with Russia, Ukraine? oh man, you know, it will be a new world order, da, 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 da. And then you say, but the rent is tanking. You're about to lose your access to the biggest market in the Americans are going to go away and say, AGOA, well, why should we be doing this? 7,800 products that you get into the U.S. tariff-free, suddenly you're going to be paying more to get those products into the U.S. And no, but you know, our friends, can I just say, I want to make this point and I'll make it again and again. There is this myth in South Africa that the Russians stood by the liberation movements. We need historians here. In 1963, the ANC took 20 people to Moscow. They were trained. The next 400 were trained in Kiev and Odessa, which is in Ukraine. Over the 70s, if you go to Kiev and Odessa, you will find Mahlangus there. You will find many, many black South Africans who fled in 1976, ended up in Odessa and Ukraine. So this whole entire thing that, no, but we must stand with the Russians, they helped us. The Union of Soviet Socialist Republics helped us. And in the USSR, it was Russia, it was all kinds of, including Ukraine. So, I mean, we are on this journey. I'm not sure why, and it's going to just really hurt us. I'm sorry to say, Anthea, I don't know what we at today, 1976 to the dollar. But if this continues, the currency is going to take an even bigger beating. And you know, there is pain ahead on this path. And we can talk about it.
What about all those people who said, oh, no, all you have to do is get rid of Jacob Zuma, all those very smart people at News 24 who told us, no.
Some of them were on the burning platform, I have to confess.
pray for Cyril, you know. As soon as he comes in, everything will be fine. As long as we get rid of Gedleyihiza, everything's cool.
Well, I think the fundamental mistake, and I think I'm one of those people who made that mistake, was to say, this individual is amazing and so forth, without looking at the ANC as a whole. The ANC as a whole is in terminal crisis. And it's taken. Cyril Ramaphosa wants to save the ANC and save the ANC by his own standards. That is, keep the ANC together, keep the faction that was the Jacob Zuma faction in-house and so forth. So part of it, I mean, an extraordinary thing happened on Friday in Parliament. Sidney Mufumadi, the National Security Advisor to President Ramaphosa, says, Andre de Ruyter gave me the name of the politicians that are implicated in corruption at Eskom. All along, the ANC, even today, is saying, I'm suing Andre de Ruyter for how dare he say blah, blah, blah.
We have yet to see the case open.
But this is a man who went to the Pravin Gordhan has admitted that, yes, he did give me the names. The National Security Advisor has admitted that, yes, I was given the names. So right now, Andre de Ruyter is hiding somewhere in Germany, I believe. Also, while the ANC is suing him, no one is saying, we don't have electricity. What are we doing to fix that problem? Because, quite frankly, the ANC can go after de Ruyter all it likes, but my mother doesn't have electricity. Right now, my mother has a borehole, which I sunk for her 25 years ago. Now, she's saying, Justice, my son, you live in America. Where's my generator? So my mother is basically going to run a government.
Yes, in her own house.
In her own house. Because
she does not use the government at all.
She doesn't use that. My mother...
She's never had security.
She's never had security. So
now she doesn't have water or electricity. So what does the state do for her?
And this is fundamental to what a state means. If we don't, because the people in this room have ADT or whatever their service is called, they have inverters for when the lights go out, they have da da da, and all these things. So all of us are, this is the state of Gareth Cliff, and that is the state of Muzi. And everyone has their own little local municipality running in their own home. No one goes. So when this crisis started in Hammanskraal a week ago, I looked back at the articles I wrote. 4 years ago, a friend of mine died at Jubilee Hospital. This is the hospital where the cholera patients are being treated. I wrote about going to see him and sitting there while rats scuttled across the floors. You can find it, it's on Times Live. Just do Justice Malala Jubilee Hospital. The trash, the garbage stuff was not changed for days on end. So this is a government hospital that is now the epicenter of the treatment of this outbreak. So I just think South Africa, we all need to do something and do something very urgently and very quickly because at every level, we just seem to be regressing.
But the key question then, because I think everybody here agrees with that, is what? What do you do? I mean, what can citizens do? We can complain. We do that.
So
South Africans complain better than anyone else. We hear people talking about a tax revolt. That's never going to happen. We hear people talking about the elections, the next elections. Oh, no, the next elections will sort it out. You wrote a book a couple of years ago called We Have Now Begun Our Descent, right?
Mm.
That was the first book you brought out. That was how many years ago?
2015.
No matter how much fuel your plane has, if you're still descending after then, that's a hell of a long time to be in descent. You should have crashed by now. So give us some hope, for God's sake, or at least tell us what we should be doing.
This is the tough questions, I guess, so I'm going to leave now. I'm working on a project at the moment, and it's my little project. And my little project is this. 40 million people were eligible to vote in the local elections in November 2021. Out of those, only 26 million were registered to vote. So already 14 million have decided are not going to be on the day because when you vote, you know, you have to be on the voter's roll. So 14 million took themselves out of the system, boom, right from the onset. Mm-hmm. So you're left with 26 million. On the 1st of November, only 12 million actually turned up and voted. So out of 40 million people, just 25%, 26%, 27% turned up to vote. If in 1990 I talk about my own hope, my own personal hope that things are going to get better, one of the key things about 1994 was that, my word, for the first time in my life, Muzi and I could go and vote. We could express our own will and say, this is what we want. So my own little project is to get out of that 12 million, to get those 12 million to go back and vote next year, and to get 4 million. So my number is 16 million. To get 16 million people back into voting. It's not even half. And hopefully we get to 18 or 20 million. But to get those people, and I don't. If they love the ANC and think the ANC is doing a great job, all good and fine. If they love Herman Mashaba and think he should be paying people 12 million bucks, good for them. They should go and do it. But I think that the death of trust in the institutions and what they can do is the end of it. It's the crash. It's not the descent that you talk about. Mm. So that for me is my focus for the next year. That's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm trying to do. That's what I'm trying to put together. What else can I do? What can people do? I think people understand. You talk about a tax revolt is not possible, but if you think about it, when last did you pay for driving on the highways.
No. I know we're good at that. Yeah. But the problem is most people who earn anything, and there are only a few people in this country who have work. We've got a huge unemployment problem.
Yeah.
Those who have work, they don't have a say. The tax comes off before they even. They can go to their employer, you know, some big bank, and say to them, "Oh no, I'm going to refuse this month." I mean, if they were bold enough, like the leaders of the banks were when Des van Rooyen was made minister, remember?
Yeah.
They went and sat with the president and said, "You do this, it's going to be big shit." They should do the same thing now.
Yes. So there you have the courage. There's the answer. People actually have done it before and they can do it again. Maybe this is because it looks so hard, you think it's impossible to do. But maybe this is the time to speak about what am I paying for? Because it's your tax money.
I'm all for this.
But I
just hear people making excuses the whole time, and I can see lots of people saying, "Oh no, well we can't do that. That's a step too far."
Well, I mean,
they've taken away your electricity. They're putting dirty water into your house.
People are dying of cholera when they shouldn't be dying of cholera. And so, what's a step too far? I think saying I'm going to withdraw my taxes is not a step too far. It's worth discussing as a country that, look, I mean, you guys are just not doing the right things. So what are we talking about?
So if I start and they put me in jail, will you come and speak up for me?
I'll speak up for you for sure. Will I join you? CliffCentral.com